Hello, everyone. Welcome to our afternoon session. Today we're going to be hearing from Valerie Fenwick, and she's got a very interesting topic for all of us, and I'm sure that it will help your digestion as you start thinking about all of those back doors in FIPS 140 validated products. Valerie, thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Hi, everyone. I know we all just had a big, giant lunch, nice warm soup, and this clock is going to go there now. So I will try to keep you a little more entertained with my pictures of various animals. So I hope you like them. There is perhaps a theme, and I'll let you puzzle it out. My name is Valerie Fenwick, as is noted in the program. I manage the Solaris Cryptographic Technologies team at Oracle. So anything crypto-related in the Solaris operating system is going to be under my purview. We've done one successful completed FIPS 140 validation, which took about a few years, and we are in implementation under test currently for Solaris 11.3. If you may notice, Solaris 11.3 released a little while ago. So this process is a long, heavy, slow process. So that ties in a little bit about what I'll be talking about today and how this is a very difficult process, but there are problems. Oh, shocking. So when you do your first FIPS validation, it's very exciting. It takes, as I was kind of noting, months or years of staff effort to complete this project. I mean, think about it. If you have 5 or 6 engineers working on this over 6 to 12 months, that's up to 5 to 6 years of effort, and you're not working on anything else. So you understand how important a FIPS validation is, what it's going to get you for your sales, and what it actually means for the quality of your code. So you know it's important. You've done the work. Then when you start getting to the point where the lab is starting to ask some questions, you've got to start providing documentation. They want to see your systems fall over flat. You spend weeks of long nights getting this all done. Then your lab says, hey, it looks pretty good, submits it to NIST into the CMPP queue, and you wait very, very patiently, of course, never complaining, ever. Very patient, then NIST will pop up and they'll say, tell me about your entropy sources, or whatever else they ask you about, but I assume for everyone else it's primarily about your entropy sources. So you answer as quickly as possible, you get the hardware engineers from all over the world, you get everyone to come in and make sure that their answers are accurate and prompt and get it taken care of. The CMVP goes, looks good, gives you a certificate, yes! So we get to have our happy dance and sing a song and frame your certificates, have a party. If you're in my team, then there will be cake, guaranteed, probably dinner, and thank the IT department for shuffling hardware, moving it into different labs so that it could be accessed for physical testing and all of that. They've given you all the special stuff. You've done all this work, all this money. It's great. Everything's perfect. But what if it's not perfect? What if your software is not correct? What if, in your desperate attempt to get your product validated while it was still relevant, and you hired some new engineers to help you do this, or contractors, what if they weren't who they said they were? What if they were additionally being paid by someone else? Or what if they were just really bad programmers? What if the standard you followed that was recommended by your government was flawed? What if you don't find the issue, but someone else does? But your product was validated, right? It's correct, right? Now, I think nowadays nobody would argue that we're being paranoid here, worrying about the source of our standards, worrying about the correctness and validity of our data and our cryptography implementations. Bruce Schneier, Professor Gene Spafford at my alum, Jim Hughes, and all kinds of other cryptographers have been warning us about government spying and backdoors for years. We said, okay, guys, that's great. I'll get you a tinfoil hat. Stop bothering me. I attended DEF CON for, about 16 years, something like that. And every year, there was rumors flying around about Echelon, the great surveillance system of worldwide governments, and how can we protect ourselves from it? And we all said, well, That's pretty easy, just end-to-end cryptography. That's what you need. Phil Zimmerman's been telling us that since, 1994 or something. Let's get on bandwagon. Easy peasy. As long as we have end-to-end cryptography, nobody can listen to our phone calls or, read our messages that we're sending to each other or emails. And then 2013 happened. Edward Snowden released a few files, a couple, that proved, beyond a doubt, to most of us U.S. citizens, that the U.S. government and other governments and other companies were actively trying to subvert cryptography with backdoors. They said they had task force trying to influence standards bodies, that they were directly implementing backdoors in code or encouraging others to create backdoors. Again, this goes back to how well do you trust every engineer that is on your team working on your sensitive cryptographic code? How well do you trust your entropy sources? I talked this morning about DevRandom on various operating systems, and if you came to that talk, you'll know they're all completely different and have been worked on by completely different people. So source of your entropy, source of your data, source of your standards matters. We shouldn't have really been surprised by this. And all of you hopefully know now I'm talking about dual ECDBRG as one of the standards that it has a known backdoor in the standard. Dan Schumo and Niels Ferguson told us about it at the RUMP sessions in 2007. Granted, they only had about 4 or 5 minutes to go through all of the flaws in this standard, but they were very clear that there was a backdoor. Other cryptographers, such as Bruce Schneier, read the research, said, they're right. And he amplified their research and talked about it in Wired magazine, very clear and uncertain terms that there was a back door in dual ECDRBG. That was in 2007. Even further back, the potential vulnerability was also discussed in the ANSI standards body. As early as 2005. My next slide goes on to prove how I know they were talking about it in 2005. But they said, you're only vulnerable to an administrator who knew the values used to calculate P and Q, which would be necessary in order to calculate P and Q. But to work around it, the standard provided some hard-coded suggested values for P and Q, which we all now know as the NSA values. And most people said, well, let's not use them. But to prove that the ANSI standards body had prior knowledge of this backdoor, you can look at a Certicom patent filed in 2005. Certicom was an active participant on the ANSI standards body working on dual ECDBRG. If P and Q are established in a security domain controlled by an administrator and the entity who generates Q for the domain does so with the knowledge of E or indirectly via knowledge of D, the administrator will have an escrow key for every ECRNG that follows that standard. The rest of their patent went on to discuss software protections you could put in place. I guess you could probably get the software from them to protect yourself from this backdoor on a standard that they were actively helping to create. Now, whether they contributed to the backdoor or just thought, hey, it's here, we'll make a protection for it, doesn't really matter to me because this is in 2005. We continued using this until 2015. So who really calculated the recommended P and Q? As mentioned before and as we've all heard, everyone's guessing it was the NSA. I'm betting nobody from the NSA here will confirm nor deny. That's okay. But somebody did. That somebody will have escrow keys to this algorithm. So everybody said, don't use the P and Q. Create your own. Well, then we could possibly have the same problem. Do you really want your vendors, as a U.S. government, do you want your vendors having a backdoor to all your DRBGs? Probably not, I'm guessing. But you probably had one running in your networks for quite a long time. The other problem here, of course, is math is hard, cryptography is hard. We've heard this over and over in every talk, and it's very likely that people sometimes just get this wrong because it's hard. There were significant delays.
NIST did not remove their recommendation of the algorithm until September 2013. They quickly reopened the comment period on SP 890A, S90B, and 90C. Made strong recommendation against using dual EC-DRBG, and forced all validated vendors to update to a new DRBG on January 1st, 2016. But this was pretty much everybody. Even if you hadn't used dual EC-DRBG, you still had to update your validation. From reading the press reports in Wired, the Washington Post, etc., about this time period, a lot of the press actually thinks that all of those validations that were canceled, actually from 2015 time period specifically, all those validations that were canceled were because people were using dual EC-DRBG, when really it's just that the standards for which what you could use had revved. Everybody had to move. So in one way, it makes everybody look bad that we've all used this. On another hand, it's very confusing and unclear to the general U.S. population about what was happening here. So in the meantime, between 2013 and December 31st, 2015, FIPS 140-2 validations were completed. Products were validated that included the dual EC-DRBG retained their validation, even when it was a default algorithm. Fortunately, a lot of vendors never implemented it. Dual EC-DRBG, sorry, it is a mouthful to say, is very slow. So that's the reason why most people didn't even implement it. OpenSSL did, and as you know from Tim Hudson's talk earlier, that involves is involved in like 200 and some odd validations on the U.S. government website. So OpenSSL did use it, but they had a major coding error that prevented it from even working at all. It would just error out right away. So at least people using OpenSSL were safe. Again, putting on my tinfoil hat, worrying about the large crypto library manufacturer, who was unnamed here, but you can figure out from the references section at the end, was accused of taking a $10 million in U.S. dollars to make dual EC-DRBG the default algorithm in their cryptographic library. That cryptographic library, much like OpenSSL, is leveraged by many other products to get their FIPS 140 validation, is leveraged by many other products for their FIPS inside. You know, here's how we're going to solve this problem. We're going to take this library. $10 million for years shipping this backdoor. The company, of course, denies it. You know, that doesn't look good. I'm going to take money to subvert the security of my customers. That looks really bad. And they also claim that this specific company, that even though their roots are in creating original cryptography algorithms, that they don't really pay attention to that anymore, and they just rely on NIST and do whatever NIST tells them to do. The Snowden documents purportedly contradict. You can read them yourselves, see what you think. But again, this was the slowest algorithm available, and it was the default. So I'm going to jump into ScreenOS. This is the most recent vulnerability I'm sure you've all heard of. This is an OS used on the NetScreen product line that's owned by Juniper. Now, who's at fault, whether it's NetScreen before acquisition, Juniper, or some secret government agent? I don't know. And frankly, I'm terrified because I don't know. So the ScreenOS engineers, and they did this on purpose, this was planned by the company, added dual EC-DRBG to the product in 2008. That's 1 year after the general public was aware of the vulnerability, three years, after the ANSI standards body was aware. They claimed in 2013 that they weren't using it as a main DRBG, just as a seed. So, you know, if it's garbage, who cares? You know, it's fine. But why even include it when they already had another PRNG? Well, so, okay, that's fine. They decided they needed extra entropy. And they were using their safe, self-generated PNQ, not those backdoored ones from NSA. Except for, at some time in 2012, the backdoor versions were back. From the Juniper website itself, During a recent internal code review, Juniper discovered unauthorized code in ScreenOS that could allow a knowledgeable attacker to gain administrative access to NetScreen devices and to decrypt VPN connections. Just let this sink in a little bit. An attacker could log in as an administrator and read all of your traffic for years. These routers were deployed all over the world with a known backdoor. They didn't know how bad it was, but it did have a known backdoor. It was introduced along with code that was supposed to help protect against the vulnerabilities in dual ECDRBG, like these changes they made in Ike. I'll go into those in a minute. X931 PRNG was actually not on by default, just dual ECDRBG. Ike key exchanges were subverted, IPsec may as well not even have been on. It's really, really, really worse. So according to the research from Shumov and Ferguson from 2007, from their 5-minute rump session presentation, in every experiment, 32 bytes of output was sufficient to uniquely identify the internal state of the PRNG, basically to get the keys to the castle. ScreenOS changed their default for their Ike nonces from 20 bytes to 32 bytes, that exact same number that you need to find the internal state of the DRBG. Everyone else uses 20 bytes. And what makes this even more ridiculous is the default number of bytes generated at a time is only 30 bytes, so they were actually having to do two grabs from this very slow DRBG and throw away 30 bytes of data every time. Or 28 bytes, sorry, to get their 32. I don't know about you, but if I was reviewing that code, I would have some questions for the engineer writing it. We had a validated product with unvalidated code. In ScreenOS, the dual ECDRBG was not part of the FIPS validation. So you could say the labs and NIST, they didn't miss anything. It wasn't part of their boundary. It wasn't part of their validation. It was supposedly not used. Except it was used, and in ways that impacted security. And not to harp too much on dual ECDRBG, but it's not the only issue out there. SOCAT, which replaced NETCAT, is a popular network analysis tool out there that last year had a fix, well, actually a few years ago had a fix added that was discovered last year to add a special prime number for Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, except it wasn't prime. So for those of you who understand the low-level mathematics of this, understand that that means it's not secure. So whether this was a coding mistake, it's open source code. As we heard this morning, OpenSSL is only starting to do code reviews, something those of us in industry have been doing for 20, 30 years. I mean, NIST and IAP kind of want us doing these. It's important. So you're not the only person judging your code as good. This could have been just an honest mistake, but nobody noticed. In this specific case, contrary kind of argument, I think a 140-2 validation would have helped. But how would FOSS ever afford to do one of these? And it was just for transmitting data securely over the network, just for a little network analysis tool, not for mission critical stuff, except for it's used for mission critical diagnostics. So just trying to think about that. How can we help that situation be a little bit better and ways it'll make better for everyone as well? I kind of liked the video yesterday where there was going to be free validations and free standards and everything, but it could be an option. But what's really important here is to make sure we have all learned our lesson, right? Everyone here has learned their lesson, right? We're not going to use dual ECDRBG, right? Yeah, perfect. Great. So John Kelsey of NIST noted the problems in this algorithm went undetected due to lack of academics involved in ANSI X982, which is the standard that became dual ECDRBG, because of the cost associated in participating in ANSI. Now, I know I keep hearing over and over again at this conference that the cost isn't that much. You can, you know, you only have to pay, well, $120 for this standard, $128 for this standard, and then, oh, if you want the algorithm standards that go with it, then Right, maybe, I don't know, what, $700-$800 to get all the standards involved for this? Well, and then you want someone to review your code. They've got to buy the standards too, because they can't look at your copy of the standard. And if you want a second pair of eyes on that, and you want somebody to write the test, well, they're going to have to get a copy of the standard. And this starts really adding up, and this becomes infeasible for small companies and even large companies alike. Our budgets are planned out and dedicated in very specific ways, and it's not to buying documents to implement things the government is requiring us to implement. And hence my note here about ISO 19790. I myself haven't reviewed the standard. I would love to, but you know, it's a lot of hoops to go through and to spend a lot of time to do someone else a favor kind of perspective. And certainly I don't hear a lot of academics participating in these reviews either. And I think that's where we're going to find the great, some of the great cryptanalysis and security analysis that we are leaving behind that is currently happening in our universities. Just as a note, pay to play is not a way to get FOSS involved in this. It is not a way to get more people involved in the process. We can do better. This should be obvious for everyone in this room, unless there's someone from a three-letter agency. But the purposeful backdoors are never a good thing. This might be my favorite picture from the whole deck. But backdoors are never... they're never a good idea. You can see how they've gone horribly wrong here. For ScreenOS, where they had a backdoored algorithm, but it was okay because only they had the keys, except for them when somebody changed the keys on them, but they don't know who, then the attackers thought, well, while we're in there, we'll add ourselves an administrative password on all routers, and we can just, you know, muck about and have all the fun we want. So a backdoor was used to add another backdoor. So with all these discussions that we're having with, you know, Apple and the U.S. Department of Justice saying you've got to make a backdoor. And I know there are a lot of vendors here and labs. Make sure, you know, if you're a lab, make sure your customers are not doing this to appease the United States government, because these backdoors will be subverted by people you don't want to do that. There is a way forward. There's actually a few ways forward. So my next few slides are going to be my recommendations for how we can dig ourselves out of this hole, besides the usual. Multiple code reviewers. Don't trust yourself. Check with someone smarter than you. Make sure, you know, go back and forth. Make sure you're studying the documents. Make sure someone in your organization understands the math if you're actually implementing cryptography. Don't implement somebody else. Use somebody else's implementation. But we can promote and develop open standards where academia and industry can participate alongside government. ISO and ANSI are not open standards bodies. They're not. OASIS and IETF are open standards bodies. Yes, there is a little bit of pay-to-play for members that you can get involved in more of the conferences and things like that if you do pay. But there are a lot of individuals, you see a lot of them from universities that participate in this, that don't have any corporate affiliation or backing at all. NIST and the rest of the United States government needs to investigate very seriously any indication of vulnerabilities in protocols included in FIPS 140-2 standards as approved algorithms or modes. I need to be clear here that we had 9 years of data being given away through a back door through this algorithm for 9 years before action was taken. We can do better. We want to encourage correct behavior. I think there should be a fast path for when these situations do occur, when it's, oh my gosh, I am using the world's worst algorithm that was recommended by NIST, but now NIST says, do not use, an inexpensive re-review process for vendors to update their certificates when they remove the vulnerable algorithms to encourage vendors to do the right thing. Because we'll talk about change letters in a minute, but this would be way beyond the scope of a change letter, but they're doing what you want them to do so you can actually deploy these products inside the U.S. government or make them stick with dual ECDRBG in the product. This is slightly related to flaw remediation. I'll dig in here. And you may have to do more work. If, for example, the only algorithm you had was the vulnerable one, okay, this little fast process won't work. But as we saw with most of the vendors, for the example of dual ECDRBG, they did have multiple choices. And they could have removed and kept the other choice that had already been validated. And to have a fast way of doing that, and to not have to go through years of revalidation, because it's years. I know it takes years to get to even the NIST queue, so it's years of effort. I've done it, trust me. Can we do better? Again, we can, I think we can. There is a lack of flaw remediation. I think I say this every time I come here, but it's really important. And one of the things that happens is this pushes vendors to create smaller and smaller boundaries. And the CAVP talk yesterday said, well, that's actually great because it's, you know, faster to test and it's, you know, blah, 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 it's awesome. And we do that because if any bugs come up in our product, if our boundary is small, the bugs are unlikely to be in the boundary. You know, sounds good. But it also, because we have no flaw remediation, when we do find bugs in our boundary, we do not fix them. So that sounds great. So flaw remediation should be free in monetary terms. Nothing's free in time terms. I understand that on both sides. And it should be fast. It should be less than 1 month to update your certificates. I liked Apostle's talk yesterday, although that seemed a little more CAVP than CMVP, but I like the direction that's going. So it is great to hear NIST is considering this, but we need serious flaw remediation. Again, we have change letters, yay! They cost too much, they are prohibitive. They take months or sometimes a year to even try to get to before you get to them and before you even get to NIST. And then NIST is gonna sit on it. It's gonna get evaluated at a much slower process then. It's just too slow. And particularly when you think about it, you can't just, a vendor, although Apostle was talking about possibly changing this, but right now a vendor cannot just go, look, you know, we fixed a file descriptor leak. That's it. It was not in cryptographically relevant code. Just let us update. That's a change letter. It's small enough. It's a change letter. Oh, okay, we'll do that. Oh, 7 months later, you're still trying to open contracts. You have to talk to your labs and still negotiating how much testing they're going to have to do and, you know, which consultant are we going to use? And you're scratching your head and can we run this ourselves and how much testing is needed and da-da-da-da-da. You can't get your change letter. So it does not meet the basic requirements of fast or free. It's not even cheap. I need to make this very clear. We are making a choice between real security and sales. I cannot speak for my company as a whole, but I can speak for vendors in general. And I can tell you, particularly for smaller companies, are they going to want to make sales or have a security checkbox that makes their boss happy? What's going to make their boss happier? Keeping the company afloat or losing your FIPS validation? So is this really a choice that NIST and the U.S. government wants their vendors making? Remember that the U.S. government is also going to be running these products. So you are making a choice for us to keep our FIPS 142-2 checkbox, but, you know, no security bugs fixed. The downside of the shrunken boundaries. The upside is faster to test, and CAVP finishes with them more quickly, and less testing, and it's great. That's awesome. Except for, what do we do when we make really small boundaries? We completely leave out the protocol implementations. TLS, IPsec, Ike, IkeV2, SSH, file systems, other cryptographic consumers are not validated. With a few exceptions of people who do to the paint level where they're making a very specialized product, anything like a general purpose product that's going to be shared and used in multiple areas, they are leaving these protocols out. I mean, if you think about, you know, the OpenSSL validation, well, OpenSSH leveraged it, but was OpenSSH validated? No. Was IPsec on Solaris validated? No. It's using our we're saying FIPS inside. It's using our FIPS cryptography. Okay, audience question. Where are the bugs usually found? Protocols, yes. So, great, a few people are awake, so that's awesome. They're enjoying the baby birds. And so there's really, and we cannot put them in the boundary, not with the current restrictions, because there's too much real work we have to do in here. If we find, we have a file system that has, it's encrypted. It uses our FIPS validated cryptography, but we are not putting the file system in there. Because what if there's a, God forbid, a data corruption bug or a performance issue? We need to fix that immediately, not wait 12 months for a change letter process to go through. We can't wait for that type of stuff. Stability, performance, real security fixes have got to go. We cannot risk that, and so we cannot put that code in the boundary. So the code where the most bugs are found is not getting looked at. I'm glad to hear there's some fuzz testing going in now into the CAVP test, but we need more. It shouldn't just be, did you perform this algorithm correctly, which is a great test. But what happens if we poke it this way? Think obviously things like Heartbleed and other code problems like that, where we're leaking data and you can only really tell if you poke it wrong in ways it does not expect. And think about a lot of the tests that are written for CAVP or CMVP testing. They're based around the vendor specification. Either the vendor writes them themselves or they hire a consultant to do it, but saying, here's how our API works. Don't call that. It doesn't work that way. Don't do that. And again, we're not finding bugs. If that's too much to ask for, we could also make an improvement in the boundary definition. Perhaps there would be two boundaries for a cryptographic module. Core crypto algorithm boundary that is still tightly controlled and very difficult to make changes in, but make it a little easier would be nice. And then a crypto consumer boundary that is FIPS 140 tested, but the code can change in patches if vendor has acceptable flaw remediation processes in place. This is how the CC evaluation has worked for years. It's not that hard. Let us do it. Let us help. Let's help each other do the right things for all of our customers. So, in summary, I think I talked fast again. Sorry. We can do better. I am convinced the people in this room are the right people to help encourage yourself as a product vendor, your lab, NIST, to do the right thing. And this is all of us are responsible for this. Make sure you do code reviews, get the right people on them, that kind of thing. But you want to develop all standards using open standards bodies. Again, that's not ANSI, I'm sorry. Or have a way to open them at least for review, true public review, not a public review internal people that are ANSI members. At least that would help a lot, I think. And we need to promptly, and this is actually for all of us, and this is kind of for NIST originally, but to investigate and take action on any suggestions of backdoors and vulnerabilities in approved algorithms. But I think that's important for vendors and labs as well. We don't need to just do what NIST is telling us. We can tell NIST, hey, look, this is really bad, and here's the proof. Sorry you guys missed that, but take a look. And NIST should be looking at this. If somebody says this algorithm has a hole, and they're saying it in Wired Magazine, in the Washington Post, in the Guardian, how are we still saying it's approved? Okay, sorry, soapbox down. We want to have a fast, cheap re-review process for when people remove a newly vulnerable algorithm. This is something, if we find out there's something wrong in a TLS protocol or something wrong in AES or something wrong, God forbid, in SHA-3, we have to have a way for people to move forward. It's already hard enough to move forward because you have to move all the applications, all of that, but having additional roadblocks with your validation doesn't help. Please, for the love of God, introduce a flaw remediation process. Please. Allow for multiple boundaries reviewed at different levels of scrutiny with different levels of flaw remediation available. And add negative and fuzz testing. That's all I ask, just a couple of things. But that's what I think we need to do this correctly.
And that is the end, besides pages of research that you can go through at your own perusal. But are there any questions? And if there are, please use the microphone.
This isn't really a question, it's additional information.
Thank you.
You said, oh, those isospecs are expensive. So I did count up what it was going to cost me to buy 1907-1912.
And its friends?
And its references. The answer is $4,721 from ANSI and more from ISO.
Oh, so my $800 was a huge underestimation. Thank you very much, David. So. $4,000, let's see, okay, what other projects could I do for $4,000?
Excuse me, that's not true. The annexes in 1790 are going to be replaced by Mint with annexes that only point to today's fifths and special publications for the cryptography, which are still free. All you're paying for is the 1790 and 24759 with ETR, which are not crypto standards. They're how to build a widget. All the crypto is in the annexes, which are all the free bits and special publications.
So that was a comment from Randy, that the annexes will be special publications from FIPS, and they will be free, just not right now? Is that what?
No, they've always been free. The algorithmic FIPS
of the algorithmic FIPS
and special publications are always free and will continue to be free, and 1790 is written so a validation point can replace the ISO annexes with the national body or validation program to recognize algorithms, which in the U.S. will be the existing NIST special publications and algorithmic FIPS.
So that's from Randy again, saying that because the ISO standard is an international standard, that you can replace the annexes in per country with your own, and currently NIST is still giving all of those documents away for free, which contain the cryptography. Not to argue too much with you, but I am constantly approving purchases for ANSI documents for my team, for my cryptographers. So maybe I have to, you know, go lecture them, but when I usually talk to folks, I hear there's no other source for some of these ANSI docs. So there's, and if maybe nothing else, there's confusion. So it's quite expensive still, and it is hard for FOSS to even consider that. And I think we're leaving a lot of security on the table with FOSS not being validated at all. Are there any additional questions or comments? Can you use the microphone? Get close.
I can. Yes, I'll do the obscene thing with the microphone again. I'm good at that. I'm just puzzled about some of the points that you brought up. I mean, I cheer you, I do. But it just seems so incredibly counterintuitive, because as I understand it, that Juniper product, I mean, yes, the U.S. Mm-hmm. government was using it
mm-hmm.
and using a highly imperfect product from the security standpoint. Mm-hmm. So where was the legislative outcry about that? I get that's nice.
There wasn't one.
No, and I guess that's sort of, see, that's
and,
what I
and they, and they and they and sadly, a lot of our legislatures, particularly the ones that often sit on science and technology councils, don't have a lot of science background or technology background, and I don't think that they see the Juniper backdoor that affected the U.S. government as something that should prevent them from putting a backdoor on your phone. They don't see the parallels there.
And yet, you know, in my own, I know it's not just my own country, but I know for sure in this country there's concern about parliamentary privilege. They begin to understand what some of this means to their day-to-day work. So I do think that there's a dawning recognition that, hey, that's kind of an issue for me personally, but, you know, that it should expand out to how government functions properly, that perhaps the risk assessment is not the best.
And I think that that's really good point. And it goes back to my point earlier with no flaw remediation. The U.S. government is having us choose a tick box to make sales or actually have a secure product. I mean, it was secure as of the date when we did it, as with all of our knowledge, but bugs come out and you go, oh, crap, I got to fix that.
So there
is definitely a disconnect in the government. And hopefully some folks here who do work for different government offices can go back to work and tell their boss, hey, let's stop doing it this way. Let's look at these other new ways. Can we consider these other options?
Can I ask one last question?
Sure.
About that aspect of how we're doing it? Why is it that a change letters would take so long? Is that literally a bureaucratic problem?
You can't just go do a change letter. And if I'm wrong, someone from one of the labs could step up and correct me. But I can't just go, hey, I'm going to go do a change letter, and I'm going to submit this thing to NIST all by myself. Oh, no. You have to get the labs involved. And getting the labs involved, they make us pay them. I don't know why. I guess they want to have a roof over their heads, so, and eat, and those strange basic needs. So that's not free. And any time you get into giving money to someone, there has to be a contract. And that's not free of your time or their time. And it goes back and forth. And for some small companies, that's not a problem. Some larger companies, doing a contract can take sometimes a couple of months to get it back and forth, agree on the language, agree on the deadlines, and then, well, we spent 2 months on this, and now we still have the security bug we haven't fixed, and keeps adding on, and then the more time you spend there, the more time more money it costs, because your engineers are working on this change letter, and they're not working on fixing code, and there's a lot of, and then there is actually, you have to do testing again for change letters, so you have to redo your CAVB testing, and get your certificates, and that's not free. Often, particularly if you're using a consultant to do your testing as opposed to doing it yourself, because it is hard to keep up with the CAVP rules and new vectors that they release. And it's possible, and some people do that themselves in-house, but it's money that adds up, and it can be, I've heard estimates between $25,000 to $75,000 to do a change letter once you get all the process in place for various companies. So that's, again, going, or I can hire another engineer. So there's a lot of decisions to make here. I think we have time maybe for one more question. Oh, okay. Oh, maybe two more questions.
We still have 10 more minutes.
Oh,
there's
awesome.
More question time. But I would like to propose that possibly there's another option we might be able to look at. So my company is in a remarkable position in that our customers will take our patch release for remediation and they don't require a revalidation.
That's some customers will
yes.
accept a patch without revalidation and some won't.
And so, if those customers, if more of them began to say, yes, we want the security fixes, please give them to us, and just tell us.
Just
all
ignore
of the
FIPS.
Yeah,
and
basically.
Yeah.
I mean, you did it in a patch. These are the vulnerabilities that you fixed. Okay, we trust that because we want that more than we care about you doing a revalidation.
And that is definitely
that could change the tide.
And that is definitely an option. Cause that time then is as fast as you can turn around a patch. Mm-hmm. That can be 2 days.
Yes.
Yes, Randy.
We have advised federal agencies that if a critical security patch is coming out, we've advised them to apply the patch immediately without the validation, but by policy to follow up in the future when the revision comes out that revision should be validated down the road. But if it is a critical security patch, apply it immediately. And that is the advice to all U.S. federal agencies.
So Randy updated, just for the recording, Randy updated that the U.S. government is recommending that everybody apply critical security patches immediately and wait for the next validated version, which I'm telling you won't come. The critical security fix will, but the updated validation version for some vendors will come. Alex, if you could come to the microphone, that'd be awesome. So we can try to catch these questions and comments.
It was a great talk. Thank you very much. I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I work for a lab, and personally I believe in the patch first, be compliant later. I think that's a great thing. And I know you're saying you be compliant, not necessarily, but you know.
It depends on your customers. Some customers are not keen on this. There's customers outside of the U.S. government financial industry that are also very interested in FIPS because they like the benefit it provides.
So one of the problems I see coming from the evaluation side is I agree with the concept that as the boundary gets smaller, the value that it's providing is reduced, but increasing it also then increases the evaluation time, which costs you more time and money, mm-hmm. and we're back to that, it's going to take years, and...
It would already take years.
So 3 years is okay.
So 2000, we released Solaris 11.3 in August 2015. We are still in implementation under test.
And let me tell you, my team worked really hard before that went out the door, and it's not like we decided 6 months after, oh, let's start a FIT validation. No, like, this, it takes time. It takes, there's a lot of moving parts you have to coordinate, and it turns out, like, you know, consultants and labs have other customers too, and they can't just come to your office like, hey, tomorrow we want to do a validation.
Depends,
you know,
how much you pay.
So, but yeah, so there, you can, exactly as Tammy said, you can just say, hey, accept it, this isn't validated, but here you go. I mean, clearly in cases like Heartbleed, you're going to go, oh my God, yeah, let's do that. but Heartbleed is an excellent example of OpenSSL made their boundary so small that where Heartbleed was outside of the boundary, so the patch was able to go out immediately.
Yeah, okay. I'd just leave and say, I think evaluation methodologies at the moment are kind of based on the waterfall method of development, and I think that's fundamentally doesn't work these days, and I agree, it needs to change. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Valerie. Thank you.
Oh, hi, Basil.
So it seems like the previous conversation and the previous question actually is a great setup for my question. We seem to be conflating economic and technical issues all along in this debate about boundaries and revalidations and things like that. And it seems like we're sort of constrained by the way we think about how validations should go, right? And the point that I was trying to make yesterday was that we have to change the balance by incentivizing companies to do more. And instead of relying on this sort of artificial construct, in particular in software, we sort of draw a boundary around the high-level code implementing an algorithm without even thinking about the low-level system libraries or big integer arithmetic that is left out of the boundary, and yet it's critically important for the correct execution of cryptography. So the question is that, what can you do to sort of make the question of boundary selection irrelevant? And the only one you can think of is to sort of automate the testing, that you can produce a verifiable artifact that anybody can exercise and verify quickly that the module performs correctly in the environment where it was intended. And then you don't need to define a boundary. You test OpenSSL, and in the environment it works, and that's what you prove. The entire stack is verified that it works correctly.
And that sounds exactly like the right way to go, where a revalidation takes, you know, from the description of your thing, maybe a few hours, you know, maybe a couple of days, depending on how long the tests take to run, but very quick.
And so I basically want to sort of open the challenge for the industry and say, hey, but that would require you to sort of re-engineer the way you develop and test modules, your own cryptography, right? So you have to develop this test automation. And so that's...
Most vendors, I bet, do have automated... I mean, we have automated tests, but they don't meet your needs.
And so that's really the purpose of this working group that we're trying to sort of get off the ground and find what is the right balance between company testing, independent laboratory testing, and government verification. What does this mean in today's level of technology? And so I'd invite you and everybody else to sort of participate and help us find the right solutions there.
Thank you very much, Apostle. Yes, everyone should join the working group, all of you. That'll make this committee work easier when there's more than like five people.
I have a very quick question. Randy, you talked about some guidance that you can provide to federal government customers that's saying pick up the critical patch now and then worry about FIPS later. Is that public, and can we get that to give to our customers?
Yes, how do we point them to it?
My understanding was that was conveyed to the agency CIOs. I don't know exactly who did that. It's been many, many years ago. Where that advice had been given, I don't know if it's written down or who does it.
Okay, could someone from this take a look at that and get that on the, you know, the SIPS website so that that is out there in public?
Matt Scholl should be the contact.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Alex. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, all right.
Employee is Louis. And the first name is Fabien.
Fabien?
Yes.
The boy. Okay. And father?
Fedez.
Okay. Yeah. I always forget.
For those of you who are having some conversations, if you can head out of the room so that we can get a setup for the next one. Well, unless you want to stay, in which case then you should stay and talk later.